the Gaza Strip. He's due to address Parliament, hold wide-ranging talks with his counterpart Benjamin Netanyahu, and meet President Isaac Herzog.
Thousands of Filipinos marching on the streets of Metro Manila over corruption allegations linked to government spending on flood control infrastructure.
And Hong Kong delivers its annual budget today amid expectations of the city ending its long run of budget deficits on account of a resurgent stock market.
In moments from now, President Trump will deliver his State of the Union address, the first in his second term.
Yeah, Mr. Trump will likely tout achievements in peace deals and trade agreements. Analysts expect him to focus on domestic issues, especially ahead of the crucial November midterm elections.
You are looking at live pictures from Congress, where lawmakers from both chambers, the Supreme Court, senior administration and military officials, as well as invited guests, are assembling to hear the president's speech. We saw his cabinet arriving moments ago. You're looking at his health secretary. That's the Christy Noem, who heads the Homeland, if I'm not wrong, the Department of Homeland Security. This address seen as a test of the U.S. leader's ability to recapture political momentum amid sliding approval ratings and mounting criticism over his policies.
Yeah, Chief of Staff Susie Wiles was there as well. You're seeing Trump's children in the shot just earlier as well. And we know that the economy remains front and center, with voters concerned about the cost of living, blaming the president's tariff agenda. Remember, the Supreme Court had struck down his flagship Liberation Day levies. He then announced a 10% global duty, and then he hiked that to 15%, but only 10% went into effect on Tuesday. Now, the White House says it is looking to raise it to 15%, but America's trade partners have been told to abide by trade deals already struck. And the flip-flops causing significant confusion over U.S. trade policy.
On the foreign policy front, there are concerns over the U.S. becoming increasingly poised to attack Iran over its nuclear program. Polls suggest most Americans do not support a war with Iran. Mr. Trump expected to reveal more about America's intentions with regard to Iran.
And Simon Marks is closely monitoring the president's speech for us, and he joins us right now from Washington, D.C. Simon, let's look at this, you know, speeches preview. I mean, how much of this is going to be messaging for voters ahead of the November midterms, given Trump's approval ratings have been waning?
No question about that, Liz. The president walks into the chamber in a few moments' time to make this State of the Union address with headwinds buffeting him and opinion polls showing that his approval rating in this country has never been lower. We've seen today and yesterday polling carried out by both CNN and The Washington Post suggesting that as many as 63% of voters, 60% in The Washington Post poll, disapprove of President Trump's time back in office. And he is underwater in virtually every poll on virtually every major issue. And tonight, particularly Americans tuning in from coast to coast, I think it's fair to say, want to hear a message that he feels their pain over affordability, the cost of groceries, the soaring costs this winter of energy. They want to hear the president connect with them, and he needs to connect with them if he is going to succeed in turning some of those polling numbers around. But remember also, from an international perspective, he walks into the chamber of the House of Representatives tonight, just days after the Supreme Court eviscerated his tariffs, the centerpiece not just of his trade policy, but also of his foreign and national security policy. And there you see four members of the Supreme Court who are in the chamber for the speech tonight. Three of them, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Elena Kagan, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett, a Trump appointee, voted with the majority to incinerate those tariffs. Here is Donald Trump arriving in the chamber. Let's listen. So President Trump walking into the chamber to a hero's welcome from the Republicans in the room. He will be aware that tonight there are at least 30, possibly as many as 50 Democratic Party lawmakers who are in an unprecedented move, not only boycotting his speech, but also attending a live play-by-play rebuttal event that Democrats and their supporters have billed as the State of the Swamp event. And many of those Democrats choosing not to be in the chamber for this speech, that may be a weakness for them, because it may convey to the television audience watching that the president's getting more applause than he might actually have been getting had the Democrats been in the room and been vocally expressive about their dismay at elements within his speech. But now he makes his progress down that corridor, and in a moment, we're going to see him come face to face with the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. There was a very awkward moment just a couple of minutes before we came on air, when Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, the architect of the president's tariffs, came face-to-face with John Roberts. And Howard Lutnick smiled and shook his hand, and John Roberts looked like a man who wanted to glance in the other direction from Howard Lutnick's gaze as quickly as possible. We're going to be watching the body language when President Trump comes face-to-face with those Supreme Court justices very closely in just a few moments, because his excoriation of the court on Friday. I mean, he essentially accused the six justices who voted his tariffs down as being traitors to the nation's cause. We also now have excerpts of what the president is going to be saying in this speech. He's going to say that with dignity and pride, over the last year, the country has achieved a transformation like no one has ever seen before, a turnaround for the ages. We will never go back, he says, to where things were just a short time ago. He is going to make a plea for and an expression of national unity. There we now are seeing him very, very briefly shaking hands with the members of the Supreme Court who are in the room, four of the nine, including Amy Coney Barrett, the last there, very brief. Momentary interactions between President Trump and those Supreme Court justices. Certainly not very much warmth there coming from him towards them, or indeed, apart from Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who voted to keep the tariffs in place, from them in his direction. The president, speaking of tariffs, is going to talk about trillions of dollars of investment and, of course, tariff duties pouring into the United States. And he's going to talk about making peace wherever he can, but saying that he will never hesitate to confront threats in America wherever we must. In a moment, he will hand the copy of his speech to the two men behind him, Vice President J.D. Vance and the Speaker of the House of Representatives, Mike Johnson. Speaker Johnson would be, I think it is safe to say, curious as to whether he's going to be standing at that podium this time next year, because it is perfectly possible that if the Democrats win the midterm elections in November, Speaker Johnson, of course, will be replaced by a Democrat. It will happen if the Democrats win. Speaker Johnson will not be behind that podium next year. But for now, President Trump soaking up the applause in the room. I should warn everybody that we may be in for a very long presidential speech tonight. The president himself has said it's long. Some White House sources were telling reporters and congressional sources telling reporters today that it could be 2 hours, possibly even longer, which I think will test the attention span of the audience watching him on television and online here in the United States. But he's got a lot that he wants to express and get off his chest, including a proud restatement of his insistence that the American economy is soaring towards prosperity, even though many Americans don't feel it. Here's the formal introduction of President Trump.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much.
Chants
everybody.
Of USA really in the chamber as the applause continues for President Trump, and here he is.
Vice President Vance, First Lady of the United States. Second Lady of the United States. Members of Congress and my fellow Americans, our nation is back, bigger, better, richer, and stronger than ever before. Less than 5 months from now, our country will celebrate an epic milestone in American history, the 250th anniversary of our glorious American independence. This July 4th, we will mark 2.5 centuries of liberty and triumph, progress and freedom in the most incredible and exceptional nation ever to exist on the face of the earth. And you've seen nothing yet. We're going to do better and better and better. This is the golden age of America. When I last spoke in this chamber 12 months ago, I had just inherited a nation in crisis with a stagnant economy, inflation at record levels, a wide-open border, horrendous recruitment for military and police, rampant crime at home, and wars and chaos all over the world. But tonight, after just 1 year, I can say with dignity and pride that we have achieved a transformation like no one has ever seen before, and a turnaround for the ages. It is indeed a turnaround for the ages. And we will never go back to where we were just a very short time ago. We're not going back. Today, our border is secure. Thank you. Today, our border is secure. Our spirit is restored. Inflation is plummeting. Incomes are rising fast. The roaring economy is roaring like never before, and our enemies are scared. Our military and police are stacked, and America is respected again, perhaps like never before. After 4 years in which millions and millions of illegal aliens poured across our borders, totally unvetted and unchecked, we now have the strongest and most secure border in American history, by far. In the past 9 months, zero illegal aliens have been admitted to the United States. But we will always allow people to come in legally, people that will love our country and will work hard to maintain our country. The flow of deadly fentanyl across our border is down by a record 56% in 1 year. And last year, the murder rate saw its single largest decline in recorded history. This is the biggest decline, think of it, in recorded history, the lowest number in over 125 years, year 1900. In fact, substantially before my wonderful father, I had a wonderful father, Fred, before he was born, substantially before he was born. That's a long time ago. He wouldn't like me to say that, but that's a long time ago. The Biden administration and its allies in Congress gave us the worst inflation in the history of our country. But in 12 months, my administration has driven core inflation down to the lowest level in more than 5 years. And in the last 3 months of 2025, it was down to 1.7%. Gasoline, which reached a peak of over $6 a gallon in some states under my predecessor, it was quite honestly a disaster, is now below $2.30 a gallon in most states, and in some places $1.99 a gallon. And when I visited the great state of Iowa just a few weeks ago, I even saw $1.85 a gallon for gasoline. Mortgage rates are the lowest in 4 years and falling fast, and the annual cost of a typical new mortgage is down almost $5,000 just since I took office. 1 year. And low interest rates will solve the Biden-created housing problem while at the same time protecting the values of those people who already own a house that really feel rich for the first time in their lives. We want to protect those values. We want to keep those values up. We're going to do both. And we are going to keep it that way. The stock market has set 53 all-time record highs since the election. Think of that. 1 year. Boosting pensions, 401ks, and retirement accounts for the millions and millions of Americans. They're all gaining. Everybody's up, way up. In 4 long years, the last administration got less than $1 trillion in new investment in the United States. And when I say less, substantially less. In 12 months, I secured commitments for more than $18 trillion pouring in from all over the globe. Think of it, much less than $1 trillion for 4 years versus much more than $18 trillion for 1 year. What a difference a president makes. A short time ago, we were a dead country. Now we are the hottest country anywhere in the world, the hottest. As thousands of new businesses are forming and factories, plants, and laboratories are being built, we have added 70,000 new construction jobs in just a very short period of time. It's getting bigger and bigger and stronger. Nobody can believe what they're watching. American oil production is up by more than 600,000 barrels a day, and we just received from our new friend and partner, Venezuela, more than 80 million barrels of oil. American natural gas production is at an all-time high because I kept my promise to drill, baby, drill. More Americans are working today than at any time in the history of our country. Think about that. Any time in the history of our country, more working today. And 100% of all jobs created under my administration have been in the private sector. We ended DEI in America. We cut a record number of job-killing regulations, and in 1 year, we have lifted 2.4 million Americans, a record, off of food stamps. And for all of these reasons, I say tonight, members of Congress, the state of our union is strong. Our country is winning again. In fact, we're winning so much that we really don't know what to do about it. People are asking me, please, 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 Mr. President, we're winning too much. We can't take it anymore. We're not used to winning in our country. Until you came along, we're just always losing, but now we're winning too much. And I say, no, 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 you're going to win again. You're going to win big. You're going to win bigger than ever. And to prove that point, here with us tonight is a group of winners who just made the entire nation proud. The men's gold medal Olympic hockey team. Come on in. That's the first time I've ever seen them get up. And actually, not all of them did get up. But they beat a fantastic Canadian team in overtime, as everybody saw, as did the American women who will soon be coming to the White House. They were in the Oval Office before, and I just want to say a second very big congratulations to Team USA. But I have to say that, and I told them this, and we took a vote of the team. I said, anybody votes no, I'm not doing it. So they stood there, and they weren't about to say no, because I'd never seen a goaltender play as well as goalie Connor Hellebuyck. Think of it, 46 shots on goal. And I asked him, the one shot, the one where you put your stick in the back and it hit the neck of your stick and bounced off, do you practice that, or was that a little lucky? He refused to answer that question. But I just want to tell you that the members of this great hockey squad will be very happy to hear, based on their vote and my vote, and in this case, my vote was more important, that I will soon be presenting Connor with our highest civilian honor, which we will be given and which has been given to many athletes over the years. But when I say many, not too many, like 12, it's called the highest civilian honor in our country, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Great athletes have gotten that, very great, the best, and I thought he deserved it. And I did take a vote, every single one of them. I said, I'm not giving it if anybody goes no, and every single one of them rapidly put up their hand. So I want to thank you all. What a special job you did. What special champions you are. Thank you very much. I'm also pleased to say that the next time the Olympic torch is lit, it will be here in America for the 2028 Olympics, and it's the summer version right in Los Angeles. We're going to do a good job in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is going to be safe, just like Washington, D.C. is now one of the safest cities in the country. And this year, and I must say, I got them both. I got them in my first term, and I was disappointed because I didn't think I'd be the president when this happened. But strange things took place. And now I've got them because I got the Olympics and I got the 2026 FIFA World Cup. And I wanted to claim the 250th, but I didn't get away with that one. I couldn't claim that one for myself. But we're getting the World Cup. So we have the World Cup and the Olympics coming. And that is exciting news. So this will be a year to celebrate our country and the heroes who have kept it free, men like Buddy Taggart. At age 17, Buddy volunteered to defend America in World War II, serving in the Pacific under the great General Douglas MacArthur. He fought bravely in the famous Battle of Manila, worked so hard. He was badly wounded and almost killed by enemy machine guns in Luzon. And 81 years ago this month, he liberated the largest internment camp in the Philippines, one of the largest anywhere in the world. But he earned many honors, including a Purple Heart and a Bronze Star, came home, started a family, and tonight he is in the gallery looking forward to July 4th, 2026, his 100th birthday. So, buddy, you're a brave man, and we salute you. Even in times of challenge, setback, and immense heartache, the spirit of 1776 has always shone through very brightly. It was July 4th of last year when floodwaters tore through a girls' summer camp in Central Texas, one of the worst things I've ever seen. I was there, rising 26 feet in the matter of minutes, tragically claiming many, many lives. You all remember that one. As the waters threatened to sweep her away, 11-year-old Millie Kate McClaymond closed her eyes and prayed to God. She thought she was going to die. Those prayers were answered when Coast Guard rescue swimmer Scott Ruskin descended from a helicopter above. Nobody knew where he came from. It was Scott's first ever rescue mission. A young guy, but very brave, very, very top, always top in his class. And he lifted not just Billy Kate, but 164 others to safety. People watched Scott from a distance, and they couldn't believe what they were seeing. The winds were blowing, the rain was pouring, everything was going, and that rapid water, nobody's ever seen anything like it. They said, wow, that's something. Tonight, Scott and Millie Kate are here together, reunited for the very first time. Thank you, Scott, Millie Kate. And Petty Officer Ruskin, I'm pleased to inform you that I am now awarding you the Legion of Merit for extraordinary heroism, which is what it was, extraordinary heroism. Thank you. I'd like to have the military aide to please come down and take care of the service. Military aide, thank you very much. Take care of that very important service. Thank you very much. From 1776 to today, every generation of Americans has stepped forward to defend life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And they're really doing it for the next generation. But now it's our turn. Together, we're building a nation where every child has the chance to reach higher and go further, where government answers to the people, not the powerful, and where the interests of hardworking American citizens are always our first and ultimate concern. That is the debt we owe to the heroes who came before us, and that is the promise we must keep to America for our 250th year. Last year, I urged this Congress to begin the mission by passing the largest tax cuts in American history, and our Republican majorities delivered so beautifully. Thank you, Republicans. Democrats, every single one of them, voted against these really important and very necessary massive tax cuts. They wanted large-scale tax increases to hurt the people instead. But we held strong, and with the great, big, beautiful bill, we gave you no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and no tax on Social Security for our great seniors. And we also made interest on auto loans tax deductible the first time, but only if the car is made in America. Recently in Pennsylvania, I met Megan Hemhauser, a devoted mom whose homeschools her children, beautiful, two children, during the day while waiting tables at night as her husband works overtime operating very heavy equipment. Megan is here this evening, and she's happy to tell you that she is so, so much richer because with no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and her expanded child tax credit done again by Republicans, Megan and her husband will take home more than $5,000 extra just for the year, cutting her tax bill in more than half. Megan, please stand up. We're fighting for you, Megan. Thank you, Megan. We're fighting for you, Megan. Under our bill, parents like Megan can also activate their children's brand new Trump accounts. And I didn't name it. I did not name that. Nobody believes me, but I did not name it. It was named by a very tall man sitting right there in the third row. Nice man, a good man. Tax-free investment accounts for every American child. This is something that's so special and has taken off and gone through the roof. Millions will be pre-funded courtesy of the U.S. Treasury and private individuals like Michael and Susan Dell, who have donated $6.25 billion to fund the Trump accounts for 25 million American children. They're great people. When I asked Michael Dell, how do you make all that money? He said, well, I just sat on my dorm in school, and I made computers, and I'd sell them to people. And I just kept selling and selling and selling, and pretty amazing story. That's called the American dream. He sold a lot of computers, a lot of those laptops, so I congratulate him on that. But I really thank him and Susan, as well as others like Brad Gerstner, very tremendous guy. He was behind it right from the beginning. Brad Gerstner. Thank you, Brad. So with modest additional contributions, these young people's accounts could grow to over $100,000 or more by the time they turn 18. Think of it. How much money is that for somebody that started with nothing? Over $100,000, could be much more than that. To make this investment in our children's future, go to TrumpAccounts.gov. TrumpAccounts.gov. And a lot of people are doing it. It's setting every record in the book. It's popular. They knew what it was going to take. I'm so proud of them. I'm so proud of the people that got it started. And now it's just taken off. One of the primary reasons for our country's stunning economic turnaround, the biggest in history, where the Dow Jones broke 50,000 4 years ahead of schedule, and the S&P hit 7,000, where it wasn't supposed to do it for many years, were tariffs. I used these tariffs, took in hundreds of billions of dollars to make great deals for our country, both economically and on a national security basis. Everything was working well. Countries that were ripping us off for decades are now paying us hundreds of billions of dollars. They were ripping us so badly, you all know that. Everybody knows it. Even the Democrats know it. They just don't want to say it. And yet these countries are now happy. And so are we. We made deals. The deals are all done. And they're happy. They're not making money like they used to, but we're making a lot of money. There was no inflation, tremendous growth. And the big story was how Donald Trump called the economy correctly and 22 Nobel Prize winners in economics didn't. They got it totally wrong. They got it really wrong. And then just 4 days ago, an unfortunate ruling from the United States Supreme Court, it just came down. It came down. Very unfortunate ruling. But the good news is that almost all countries and corporations want to keep the deal that they already made, right, Scott? Knowing that the legal power that I, as president, have to make a new deal could be far worse for them, and therefore they will continue to work along the same successful path that we had negotiated before the Supreme Court's unfortunate involvement. So despite the disappointing ruling, these powerful country saving, it's saving our country, the kind of money we're taking in, peace protecting. Many of the wars I settled was because of the threat of tariffs. I wouldn't have been able to settle them without. Will remain in place under fully approved and tested alternative legal statutes. And they have been tested for a long time. They're a little more complex, but they're actually probably better, leading to a solution that will be even stronger than before. Congressional action will not be necessary. It's already time-tested and approved. And as time goes by, I believe the tariffs paid for by foreign countries will, like in the past, substantially replace the modern-day system of income tax, taking a great financial burden off the people that I love. Moving forward, factories, jobs, investment, and trillions of dollars will continue pouring into the United States of America because we finally have a president who puts America first. I put America first. I love America. For decades before I came along, we had the exact opposite. From trade to health care, from energy to immigration, everything was stolen and rigged in order to drain the wealth out of the productive, hardworking people who make our country great, who make our country run. Under Biden and his corrupt partners in Congress and beyond, it reached a breaking point with the Green New Scam, open borders for everyone. They poured in by the millions and millions from prisons, from mental institutions. They were murderers, 11,888 murders. They came into our country. You allowed that to happen. And record-setting inflation that cost the typical family $34,000 in just a speck of time. Now, the same people in this chamber who voted for those disasters suddenly use the word affordability, a word they just used it. Somebody gave it to them, knowing full well that they caused and created the increased prices that all of our citizens had to endure. You caused that problem. You caused that problem. They knew their statements were a lie. They knew it. They knew their statements were a dirty, rotten lie. Their policies created the high prices. Our policies are rapidly ending them. We are doing really well. Those prices are plummeting downward. The price of eggs is down 60%, Madam Secretary, thank you. The cost of chicken, butter, fruit, hotels, automobiles, rent is lower today than when I took office by a lot. And even beef, which was very high, is starting to come down significantly. Just hold on a little while. We're getting it down. And soon you will see numbers that few people would think were possible to achieve just a short time ago. Nobody can believe when they see the kind of numbers, and especially energy, when they see energy going down to numbers like that, they cannot believe it. It's like another big tax cut. I'm also confronting one of the biggest ripoffs of our times, the crushing cost of health care caused by you. Since the passage of the Unaffordable Care Act, sometimes referred to as Obamacare, big insurance companies have gotten rich. It was meant for the insurance companies, not for the people. With our government giving them hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars a year as their stock prices soared 1,000, 1,200, 1,400, and even 1,700%, like nothing else. That's why I introduced the Great Healthcare Plan. I want to stop all payments to big insurance companies and instead give that money directly to the people so they can buy their own health care, which will be better health care at a much lower cost. In addition, my plan requires maximum price transparency. That's a big deal. Sounds so simple, so big. And I did that in my first term, and the Democrats immediately terminated it with full knowledge that they were doing a very bad thing for the people. Costs were going to go way up, and that's what happened. And now I'm bringing them way down on health care and everything else. I'm also ending the wildly inflated cost of prescription drugs like has never happened before. Other presidents tried to do it, but they never could. They tried. Most didn't try, actually. But they tried. They said they tried. They couldn't do it. They didn't even come close. They were all talk and no action, but I got it done. Under my just enacted most favored nation agreements, Americans who have for decades paid by far the highest prices of any nation anywhere in the world for prescription drugs will now pay the lowest price anywhere in the world for drugs, anywhere, the lowest price. So in my first year of the second term, should be my third term, but strange things happen. I took prescription drugs, a very big part of health care, from the highest price in the entire world to the lowest. That's a big achievement. The result is price differences of 300, 400, 500, 600% and more. All available right now at a new website called TrumpRx.gov. And I didn't name that one either, by the way. And here tonight is the very first customer ever to get that big discount, and it is big, Catherine Rayner. For 5 years, she and her husband have struggled with infertility, and they turned to IVF. One drug has been costing Catherine $4,000 to purchase. But a few weeks ago, she logged onto the TrumpRx website and got that same drug that cost $4,000, got it for under $500, a reduction of much more, actually, than $3,500. Catherine, we are all praying for you, and you're going to be a great mom. Yeah. So now I'm calling on Congress to codify my most favored nation program into law. Now, the one thing, I'm not sure it matters because it's going to be very hard for somebody that comes along after me to say, let's raise drug prices by 700 or 800%. But John and Mike, if you don't mind, codify it anyway. They may do it. Codify it anyway. Thank you. Many Americans are also concerned that energy demand from AI data centers could unfairly drive up their electric utility bills. Tonight, I'm pleased to announce that I have negotiated the new ratepayer protection pledge. You know what that is? We're telling the major tech companies that they have the obligation to provide for their own power needs. They can build their own power plants as part of their factory so that no one's prices will go up. And in many cases, prices of electricity will go down for the community and very substantially down. This is a unique strategy never used in this country before. We have an old grid. It could never handle the kind of numbers, the amount of electricity that's needed. So I'm telling them they can build their own plant. They're going to produce their own electricity. It will ensure the company's ability to get electricity while at the same time lowering prices of electricity for you and could be very substantial for all of you cities and towns. You're going to see some good things happen over the next number of years. Another pillar of the American dream that has been under attack is home ownership. With us tonight is Rachel Wiggins, a mom of two from Houston. She placed bids on 20 homes and lost all of those bids to gigantic investment firms that bypassed inspection, paid all cash, and turned those houses into rentals, stealing away her American dream. She was devastated. Stories like this are why last month I signed executive order to ban large Wall Street investment firms from buying up in the thousands single-family homes. And now I'm asking Congress to make that ban permanent because homes for people, really, that's what we want. We want homes for people, not for corporations. Corporations are doing just fine. Rachel, thank you very much. Good luck with your home. You'll get one soon. We're also working to make it easier for Americans to save for retirement. And under this administration, we will always protect Social Security and Medicare. They are not protecting it. For our seniors, we will always protect Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Since I took office, the typical 401k balance is up by at least $30,000. That's a lot of money. We have millions and millions of people, because the stock market has done so well, setting all those records, your 401ks are way up. Yet half of all of working Americans still do not have access to a retirement plan with matching contributions from an employer. To remedy this gross disparity, I'm announcing that next year my administration will give these oft-forgotten American workers, great people, the people that built our country, access to the same type of retirement plan offered to every federal worker. We will match your contribution with up to $1,000 each year. As we ensure that all Americans can profit from a rising stock market, let's also ensure that members of Congress cannot corruptly profit from using insider information. They stood up for that, I can't believe. I can't believe it. Did Nancy Pelosi stand up if she's here? Doubt it. Pass the Stop Insider Trading Act without delay. I wasn't sure if anybody even on this side was going to applaud for that. I'm very impressed. Thank you. I'm very impressed. But when it comes to the corruption that is plundering, really, it's plundering America. There's been no more stunning example than Minnesota, where members of the Somali community have pillaged an estimated $19 billion from the American taxpayer. Oh, we have all the information. And in actuality, the number is much higher than that. And California, Massachusetts, Maine, and many other states are even worse. This is the kind of corruption that shreds the fabric of a nation, and we are working on it like you wouldn't believe. So tonight, although started 4 months ago, I am officially announcing the war on fraud to be led by our great Vice President J.D. Vance. Get it done. And if we're able to find enough of that fraud, we will actually have a balanced budget overnight. It'll go very quickly. That's the kind of money you're talking about. We'll balance our budget. The Somali pirates who ransacked Minnesota remind us that there are large parts of the world where bribery, corruption, and lawlessness are the norm, not the exception. Importing these cultures through unrestricted immigration and open borders brings those problems right here to the USA. And it is the American people who pay the price in higher medical bills, car insurance rates, rent, taxes, and perhaps most importantly, crime. We will take care of this problem. We're going to take care of this problem. We are not playing games. Delilah. Delilah Colvin was only 5 years old in June 2024 when an 18-wheel tractor trailer plowed into her stopped car traveling at 60 miles an hour or more. The driver was an illegal alien let in by Joe Biden and given a commercial driver's license by open borders politicians in California. Doctors said Delilah would never be able to walk or talk. Have a good life. She wouldn't even be able to eat again. But against all odds, she is now in the first grade learning to walk. And she's here this evening with her dad, Marcus, a fantastic man. Delilah, please, you are a great inspiration. Please stand up. Thank you, Delilah. Many, if not most, illegal aliens do not speak English and cannot read even the most basic road signs as to direction, speed, danger, or location. That's why tonight I'm calling on Congress to pass what we will call the Delilah Law, barring any state from granting commercial driver's licenses to illegal aliens. Yesterday, as you probably saw at the White House, I hosted a ceremony with Americans who lost their treasured loved ones to the scourge of illegal immigration. People came into our country, how we allowed this to happen with our open borders. These are the angel moms and families that for decades our government betrayed and our media totally ignored. It was terrible. Hard to believe, actually. In 2023, a 16-year-old high school cheerleader named Lizbeth Medina was supposed to perform in her town's Christmas parade, but she never arrived. Her mother, Jacqueline, went home to look for her, and she found her lying dead in a bathtub, bleeding profusely after being stabbed 25 times. Lizbeth's killer was a previously arrested illegal alien who had broken in and brutally extinguished the brightest light in her family's life, violently and viciously. Her heartbroken mother is in the gallery to remind everyone in this chamber exactly why we are deporting illegal alien criminals to our country at record numbers, and we're getting them the hell out of here fast. We don't want them. Thank you very much, Jacqueline. Thank you. We can never forget that many in this room not only allowed the border invasion to happen before I got involved, but indeed they would do it all over again if they ever had the chance. If they ever got elected, they would open up those borders to some of the worst criminals anywhere in the world. The only thing standing between Americans and a wide-open border right now is President Donald J. Trump and our great Republican patriots in Congress. Thank you. Thank you. As we speak, Democrats in this chamber have cut off all funding for the Department of Homeland Security. It's all cut off. It's all cut off. They have instituted another Democrat shutdown, the first one costing us 2 points on GDP. 2 points we lost on GDP, which probably made them quite happy, actually. Now they have closed the agency responsible for protecting Americans from terrorists and murderers. Tonight I'm demanding the full and immediate restoration of all funding for the border security, homeland security of the United States, and also for helping people clean up their snow. We have no money because of the Democrats, and it would be nice. We'd love to give you a hand at cleaning it up, but you gave no money. Nobody's getting paid. It's a shame. So you have to think about it. We have, in case you didn't know, a pretty large snowstorm out there. One of the great things about the State of the Union is how it gives Americans the chance to see clearly what their representatives really believe. So tonight, I'm inviting every legislator to join with my administration in reaffirming a fundamental principle. If you agree with this statement, then stand up and show your support. The first duty of the American government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens. Isn't that a shame? You should be ashamed of yourself not standing up. You should be ashamed of yourself. That is why I'm also asking you to end deadly sanctuary cities that protect the criminals and enact serious penalties for public officials who block the removal of criminal aliens, in many cases drug lords, murderers all over our country. They're blocking the removal of these people out of our country, and you should be ashamed of yourself. And perhaps most importantly, I'm asking you to approve the Save America Act. To stop illegal aliens and others who are unpermitted persons from voting in our sacred American elections. That cheating is rampant in our elections. It's rampant. It's very simple. All voters must show voter ID. All voters must show proof of citizenship in order to vote. And no more crooked mail-in ballots except for illness, disability, military, or travel. None. And this should be an easy one. And by the way, it's polling at 89%, including Democrats. 89%. And even the new communist mayor of New York City, I think he's a nice guy, actually. Speak to him a lot. Bad policy, but nice guy. Just said they want people to shovel snow. They got hit hard. Wants them to shovel snow, but if you apply for that job, you need to show two original forms of ID and a Social Security card. Yet they don't want identification for the greatest privilege of them all, voting in America. No, it's no good. No good. Both Republicans and Democrats overwhelmingly agree on the policy that we just enunciated, and Congress should unite and enact this common-sense, country-saving legislation right now, and it should be before anything else happens. And the reason they don't want to do it, why would anybody not want voter ID? One reason, because they want to cheat. There's only one reason. They make up all excuses. They say it's racist. They come up with things. You almost say, what imagination they have. They want to cheat. They have cheated. And their policy is so bad that the only way they can get elected is to cheat. And we're going to stop it. We have to stop it, Josh. And here is one more opportunity to show common sense in government. In the gallery tonight are Sage Blair and her mother, Michelle. In 2021, Sage was 14 when school officials in Virginia sought to socially transition her to a new gender, treating her as a boy and hiding it from her parents. Hard to believe, isn't it? Before long, a confused Sage ran away from home. After she was found in a horrific situation in Maryland, a left-wing judge refused to return Sage to her parents because they did not immediately state that their daughter was their son. Sage was thrown into an all-boys state home and suffered terribly for a long time. But today, all of that is behind them because Sage is a proud and wonderful young woman with a full-ride scholarship to Liberty University. Sage and Michelle, please stand up. And thank you for your great bravery. And who can believe that we're even speaking about things like this? 15 years ago, if somebody was up here and said that, they'd say, what's wrong with him? But now we have to say it because it's going on all over numerous states without even telling the parents. But surely we can all agree no state can be allowed to rip children from their parents' arms and transition them to a new gender against the parents' will. Who would believe that we're even talking about it? We must ban it, and we must ban it immediately. Look, nobody stands up. These people are crazy, I'm telling you. They're crazy. Amazing. Gentlemen. Boy, oh boy. We're lucky we have a country. With people like this, Democrats are destroying our country, but we've stopped it just in the nick of time, didn't we? No one cares more about protecting America's youth than our wonderful First Lady. Now a movie star. She's a movie star. Can you believe it? Who would have believed that? Over the past year, she has had an incredible impact championing AI legislation, advancing a landmark executive order on foster care, and helping secure $30 million to launch the Melania Trump Foster Youth to Independence Initiative. It's a tremendous, really a tremendous thing that happened and had a lot of bipartisan support. She gets much better bipartisan support than I do. I get none. She gets a lot. Someday you're going to have to tell me how you did that. And students and educators in every state have joined the First Lady's efforts in the presidential AI challenge, keeping America's next generation positioned to succeed and strongly succeed in the future. Tonight, we welcome two young people whose lives reflect the First Lady's impact, Sierra Burns and Everest Nevermont. Thank you both. And Melania, thank you. I know how hard you worked on her. Thank you very much. I'm very proud to say that during my time in office, both the first 4 years and in particular this last year, there has been a tremendous renewal in religion, faith, Christianity, and belief in God. Tremendous renewal. This is especially true among young people, and a big part of that had to do with my great friend, Charlie Kirk, a great guy, great man. So last year, Charlie was violently murdered by an assassin and martyred, really martyred for his beliefs. His wonderful wife, Erica, is with us tonight. Erica, please stand. Thank you, Erica. Been through a lot. In Charlie's memory, we must all come together to reaffirm that America is one nation under God, and we must totally reject political violence of any kind. We love religion, and we love bringing it back. And it's coming back at levels that nobody actually thought possible. It's really a beautiful thing to see. Above all, unleashing America's promise requires keeping our communities safe. We have made incredible strides, yet dangerous repeat offenders continue to be released by pro-crime Democrat politicians again and again. We are honored to be joined tonight by a woman who's been through hell, Anya Zaretska. In 2022, she and her beautiful daughter, so beautiful, what a beautiful young woman, Irina, fled war-torn Ukraine to live with relatives near Charlotte, North Carolina. And by the way, what's going on with Charlotte? Last summer, 23-year-old Irina was riding home on the train when a deranged monster who had been arrested over a dozen times and was released through no cash bail stood up and viciously slashed a knife through her neck and body. No one will ever forget. There were people on that train. No one will ever forget the expression of terror on Irina's face as she looked up at her attacker in the last seconds of her life. She died instantly. She had escaped a brutal war only to be slain by a hardened criminal set free to kill in America, came in through open borders. Mrs. Zaretska, tonight I promise you we will ensure justice for your magnificent daughter, Irina. How do you not stand? How do you not stand? I'm asking this Congress to pass tough legislation to ensure that violent and dangerous repeat offenders are put behind bars, and importantly, that they stay there. Starting last summer, I deployed our National Guard and federal law enforcement to restore law and order to our most dangerous cities, including Memphis, Tennessee, big success, New Orleans, Louisiana, big success, and our nation's capital itself, Washington, D.C., where we have almost no crime anymore in Washington, D.C. How did that happen? In fact, crime in Washington is now at the lowest level ever recorded, and murders in D.C. this January were down close to 100% from a year ago. They don't like to hear that. One of the sick people, one of the brave service members who helped achieve this stunning turnaround was 20-year-old West Virginia Army National Guard Specialist Sarah Beckstrom. After a four-month deployment, she voluntarily extended her service, and her rank was going to be lifted. She was doing so well. They were so proud of her. But the very next day, she was on patrol near the White House when she was ambushed and shot in the head by a terrorist monster from Afghanistan. Shouldn't have been in our country. And all because she wore the uniform of our nation, she was shot. He traveled here because he didn't like people wearing our uniform. He was sick and deranged, shouldn't have been in our country. Sarah Beckstrom died in order to defend our capital, and we are honored to be joined by her wonderful parents, Gary and Evely. Your daughter was a true American patriot, and she will be greatly missed. She was a great person. I saw reports on her. They've never seen anything like her. So sorry. Thank you very much. A great young lady. I saw reports that were like, Perfect. She was perfect. Serving alongside Sarah that day was Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf. The terrorist shot Andrew in the head, and no one thought he could possibly make it. The two of them, Sarah and Andrew, both shot violently in the head. Neither was expected to make it. They weren't even given a chance, except his wonderful mother, named Melody, who I spoke to the same night, and she was so positive. The doctors thought that Andrew was gone, but his mother said, "No, no, Mr. President, Andrew will be fine. He's going to make it." I've never seen anything like it. I mean, he was given almost no chance. She said, "I have no doubt, sir. He's going to be okay." This was a conversation that I had with her that night, with her son laying helplessly in bed, blood all over. "Everybody is praying," she said. "Sir, he will be okay." The doctors didn't understand what she was saying. And after looking at the results of the damage done, neither did I. She was so strong and conclusive that even Andrew's great father felt she didn't really understand the gravity of the situation. But she turned out to be right. Right, Melody? She turned out to be right. Amazing, actually. I said, "Where does this woman come from? She's the most positive person I've ever met." With God's help, Andrew has battled back from the edge of death. And we're talking about the edge of death. On his way to a miraculous recovery. He's got a little work to do, but he's doing great. Nice to see you. He's a good-looking guy. Nice to see you. Thanks, Andrew. Thank you very much. So, Andrew, while you're up, now I'm going to ask a highly respected General James Seward to present Staff Sergeant Andrew Wolf and the great family of Sarah Beckstrom with the award created by our late, great President George Washington himself. It's called the Purple Heart. We love you all. Love you. We're proudly restoring safety for Americans at home, and we are also restoring security for Americans abroad. Our country has never been stronger. My first 10 months, I ended 8 wars, including Cambodia. Isn't it funny? Sick people. Cambodia and Thailand, Pakistan and India. Would have been a nuclear war. 35 million people said the Prime Minister of Pakistan would have died if it were not for my involvement. Kosovo and Serbia, Israel and Iran, Egypt and Ethiopia, Armenia and Azerbaijan, the Congo and Rwanda, and of course the war in Gaza, which proceeds at a very low level. It's just about there. And I want to thank Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner for your help. Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Jared. And I also want to thank the Mandate Report, too, Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Thank you, Marco. People don't like you. You know, Marco got 100% of the votes when he was in confirmation. I think our next one was about 54%. And some of the Democrats are now saying, I can't believe we approved that guy. And he said it's an honor that they feel that way. Right, Marco? You have done a great job. Great Secretary of State. I think he'll go down as the best ever. Under the ceasefire I negotiated, every single hostage, both living and dead, has been returned home. Can you believe that? Nobody thought it was possible. Nobody thought that was possible. Both living and dead, and those parents who had a dead son, their boy, they'd always tell me their boy. They wanted him as much as though he were living. It was an amazing period of time. And they came back, and when we got all of the living hostages back, and many, many before them, but I always said those last 20 are going to be very tough, but we got many, many more, hundreds. But I said those last 20 are going to be tough. We got them back, but we only got back 14 or 15 of the dead, of the 28. And believe it or not, Hamas worked along with Israel, and they dug, and they dug, and they dug. It's a tough thing to do, going through bodies all over, passing up 100 bodies sometimes for each one that they found. Tough job. And they finally got it back to 27. And then Steve and Jared, they got it back to 28. They found all 28. Nobody thought that was possible, but we did it. And I remember the family of the 28th. They were so grieved, but they were so happy as it's possible to be. They had their boy back. The mother said, sir, we have our boy back. What a period of time that was, but we got them all back. So thank you both very much. Great job. And we're working very hard to end the ninth war, the killing and slaughter between Russia and Ukraine, where 25,000 soldiers are dying each and every month. Think of that, 25,000 soldiers are dying a month. A war which would have never happened if I were president, would have never happened. As president, I will make peace wherever I can, but I will never hesitate to confront threats to America wherever we must. That's why, in a breakthrough operation last June, the United States military obliterated Iran's nuclear weapons program with an attack on Iranian soil known as Operation Midnight Hammer. For decades, it had been the policy of the United States never to allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon. Many decades. Since they seized control of that proud nation 47 years ago, the regime and its murderous proxies have spread nothing but terrorism and death and hate. They've killed and maimed thousands of American service members and hundreds of thousands and even millions of people. with what's called roadside bombs. They were the kings of the roadside bomb. And we took out Soleimani. I did that during my first term. Had a huge impact. He was the father of the roadside bomb. And just over the last couple of months with the protests, they've killed at least, it looks like, 32,000 protesters. 32,000 protesters in their own country. They shot them and hung them. We stopped them from hanging a lot of them with the threat of serious violence. But this is some terrible people. They've already developed missiles that can threaten Europe and our bases overseas, and they're working to build missiles that will soon reach the United States of America. After Midnight Hammer, they were warned to make no future attempts to rebuild their weapons program, and in particular, nuclear weapons. Yet they continue starting it all over. We wiped it out, and they want to start all over again, and are at this moment again pursuing their sinister ambitions. We are in negotiations with them. They want to make a deal, but we haven't heard those secret words. We will never have a nuclear weapon. My preference is to solve this problem through diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are by far, to have a nuclear weapon. Can't let that happen. And no nation should ever doubt America's resolve. We have the most powerful military on earth. I rebuilt the military in my first term. We're going to continue to do so. Also, we just approved a $1 trillion budget. We have no choice. We have to be strong, because hopefully we will seldom have to use this great power that we built together. It's really called peace through strength, and it's been very, very effective. So thanks to Republicans in Congress, we're investing that record number of dollars, have no choice, in the United States Armed Forces, also creating a lot of jobs. But we're not even doing it for that reason, because, as I said, we have more jobs, more people working today than ever before in the history of our country. And NATO countries, our friends and allies, they are. They're our friends and they're our allies, have just agreed, at my very strong request, to pay 5% of GDP for military defense rather than the 2%, which they weren't paying. We were paying for almost all of NATO. Now they're paying 5 as opposed to not paying 3. And getting that 5% was something which everyone said would never be done, could not happen. We got it really easily with one meeting. And big difference between 2% that's not paid. We were paying the freight of many of them. Very few were paid up. Now 5%, then they're paid. And everything we send over to Ukraine is sent through NATO, and they pay us in full. They pay us totally in full. Every branch of our armed forces is setting records for recruitment. This is so exciting. And every service member recently. And every service member recently received a warrior dividend of $1,776. You know, they put it on my desk. We got the money from tariffs and other things, a lot of money we have. We have much more money than people understand. Have to rebuild that program a little bit, but it won't take long. But we got the money, and it was $1,775, and they wanted my approval. And I said, what's the number? $1,775. I said, wait a minute. For one more dollar, we can have $1,776. It's going to... I said, we're going to figure that. I never asked anybody if we could afford it. One more dollar. I said, $1,776. And I said, that's good. And I'll tell you what, our military, that was 4 months ago, our military, I never see a person in the military that doesn't thank me for it. So we're honored to do it. They deserve it. And we call it 1776. It was great. And we love our military. We love our law enforcement. We love our firemen. You know, the firemen don't get mentioned enough. We love our firemen. We're also... We're also restoring American security and dominance in the Western Hemisphere, acting to secure our national interests and defend our country from violence, drugs, terrorism, and foreign interference. For years, large swaths of territory in our region, including large parts of Mexico, really large parts of Mexico, have been controlled by murderous drug cartels. That's why I designated these cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, and I declared illicit fentanyl as a weapon of mass destruction. And with our new military campaign, we have stopped record amounts of drugs coming into our country and virtually stopped it completely coming in by water or sea. You probably noticed that. We very seriously damaged their fishing industry also. Nobody wants to go fishing anymore. We've also taken down one of the most sinister cartel kingpins of all. You saw that yesterday. In January... In January, elite American warriors carried out one of the most complex, spectacular feats of military competence and power in world history. No one's seen anything like it. Foreign leaders, I won't tell you who, called me and they said, very impressive, very impressive. They couldn't believe, they all watched, they saw what happened. This is a different fighting force than we had years ago when we fought to tie. No, it's a great fighting force. I'm so proud of it. Look at Space Force. Space Force is my baby, as we did that. My baby is becoming so important. America's armed forces overwhelmed all defenses and utterly defeated an enemy, good fighters, to end the reign of outlawed dictator Nicolas Maduro and bring him to face American justice. This was an absolutely colossal victory for the security of the United States, and it also opens up a bright new beginning for the people of Venezuela. We're working closely with the new president of Venezuela, Delcy Rodriguez, to unleash extraordinary economic gains for both of our countries and to bring new hope to those who have suffered so terribly. They really did suffer. With us tonight is Alejandro Gonzalez. She grew up in a tight-knit Venezuelan family and was especially close to her beloved uncle Enrique. But after Enrique ran for office and opposed Maduro, he was kidnapped by Maduro's security forces and thrown into the regime's really infamous prison in Caracas. Alejandro feared she would never see her uncle again. She feared for her own life also. But since the raid, we have worked with the new leadership, and they have ordered the closure of that vile prison and released hundreds of political prisoners already, with more to come. Alejandro, I'm pleased to inform you that not only has your uncle been released, but he is here tonight. We brought him over to celebrate his freedom with you in person. Enrique, please come down. Thank you, Enrique. Have a good time. Nice to have you back, Enrique. There were many heroes on that January raid to capture Maduro. Really great heroes. It was very dangerous. They knew we were coming. They were all set. But the deeds of one warrior that night will live forever in the eternal chronicles of military valor. Chief Warrant Officer 5, Eric Slover, planned the mission and was the flight lead in the cockpit of the first helicopter, a big, beautiful, powerful helicopter. It was a massive Chinook carrying, as you can imagine, many, many American warfighters. Wearing the dog tags his wife Amy had blessed with holy water before he left, she knew it was going to be a rough one. Eric steered the Chinook under the cover of night and descended swiftly upon Maduro's heavily protected military fortress. This was a major military installation, protected by thousands of soldiers and guarded by Russian and Chinese military technology. How did that work out? Not too good. While preparing to land, enemy machine guns fired from every angle, and Eric was hit very badly in the leg and hip. One bullet after another. He absorbed 4 agonizing shots, shredding his leg into numerous pieces. And yet, despite the fact that the use of his legs was vital to successful helicopter flight, legs are the most important part of flying a helicopter, to deliver the many commandos who would capture and detain Maduro was the only thing Eric was thinking about. Then, even as he was gushing blood, which was flowing back down the aisle, helicopter lands at a steep angle. The machine gun stood right in front of him. They were right in front of him, 2 machine gunners who escaped the wrath of the previous planes. Eric maneuvered his helicopter with all of those lives and souls to face the enemy and let his gunners eliminate the threat. Turned the helicopter around so the gunners could take care of business, saving the lives of his fellow warriors from what could have been a catastrophic crash deep in enemy territory. Only after safely landing the helicopter with all the warriors aboard in the exact right spot, which was vital to the mission, we probably would have had to maybe cancel the mission if that didn't happen. Eric told his co-pilot, also wounded, but not as gravely, to take over. I'm about ready to pass out. The success of the entire mission and the lives of his fellow warriors hinge on Eric's ability to take searing pain. It was unbelievable what's happened to his legs. Of the bullets and keep on flying and landing, and people knew what was happening. Everybody in the back of the helicopter knew because they saw the blood pouring down the aisle. Chief Warrant Officer Slover is still recovering from his serious wounds, but I'm thrilled to say that he is here tonight with his wife, Amy. Eric and Amy, come on in. So we have a surprise for Eric and Amy. In recognition of Eric's actions above and beyond the call of duty, I would now like to ask General Jonathan Braga to present Chief Warrant Officer Slover with our nation's highest military award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Well, thank you very much, Eric and Amy. Great to get to know you. I met with them and with a lot of their fellow warriors at Fort Bragg recently. You notice the name Fort Bragg. We have it back. We brought it back. We won the First World War with it, the Second World War with it, and then they decide to change the name. So we changed it back. Everybody wanted to change back, too. And 10 of Eric's fellow warriors from that incredible night of victory will also be receiving medals at a private ceremony that will soon be held at the White House, and Eric will be there. Thank you. Thank you, Eric. That's a big one. Tonight we've celebrated many truly extraordinary American patriots, but there is one last living legend to honor before we go. He is one more heroic American aviator. Navy fighter pilot Royce Williams served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, flying more than 220 missions. In the skies over Korea in 1952, Royce was in the dogfight of a lifetime, legendary dogfight. Flying through blizzard conditions, his squadron was ambushed by 7 Soviet fighter planes. It was his first aerial combat of the war, and despite being massively outnumbered and outgunned, Royce led the takedown of 4 enemy jets and almost destroyed the others, vanquishing his adversaries while taking 263 bullets to his own plane and being seriously hurt. His story was secret for over 50 years. He didn't even want to tell his wife, but the legend grew and grew. But tonight, at 100 years old, this brave Navy captain is finally getting the recognition he deserves. He was a legend long before this evening. Royce, please stand up, and I will ask the First Lady of the United States to present Captain Royce Williams with his Congressional Medal of Honor. you, Royce, and thank you, Eric. I've always wanted the Congressional Medal of Honor, but I was informed I'm not allowed to give it to myself, and I wouldn't know why I'd be taking it, but if they ever open up that law, I will be there with you someday. But, you know, that's our highest honor, Congressional Medal of Honor, and that's a big thing, and it's an honor to be in the same room with you. Thank you both very much, Eric. Thank you. Thank you. 250 years is a long time in the life of a nation, but in another sense, it's really a mere moment in the eye of history. Two of the gentlemen we met in the gallery this evening took their first breaths one century ago, 100 years before that, on July 4th, 1826, the author of the Declaration of Independence, brilliant Thomas Jefferson, drew his last breath. Just a single long human lifespan separates the giants who declared and won our independence from the heroes who stand among us tonight. Everything our nation has done, everything we have achieved, has been the work of those few great lifetimes. In those brief chapters, Americans built this nation from 13 humble colonies into the pinnacle of human civilization and human freedom, the strongest, wealthiest, most powerful, most successful nation in all of history. Americans ventured out across the daunting and dangerous continent. We carved paths through an unforgiving wilderness, settled a boundless frontier, and tamed the beautiful but very, very dangerous Wild West. From empty marshes and wide-open plains, we raised up the world's greatest cities. Together, we mastered the world's mightiest industries and shattered history's monstrous tyrannies. And we liberated millions from the chains of fascism, communism, oppression, and terror. Americans lifted humanity into the skies on the wings of aluminum and steel. And then we launched mankind into the stars on rockets powered by sheer American will and unyielding American pride. We wired the globe with our ingenuity. We captivated the planet with American culture. And now we are pioneering the next great American breakthroughs that will change the entire world. All of this and so much more is the enduring legacy, unmatched glory of the hardworking patriots who built and defended this country and who still carry the hopes and freedoms on all of humanity's backs. For years, they were forgotten, betrayed, and cast aside. But that great betrayal is over, and they will never be forgotten again. Because when the world needs courage, daring, vision, and inspiration, it is still turning to America. And when God needs a nation to work his miracles, he knows exactly who to ask. There is no challenge Americans cannot overcome, no frontier too vast for us to conquer, no dream too bold for us to chase, no horizon too distant for us to claim. For our destiny is written by the hand of Providence, and these first 250 years were just the beginning. From the rugged border towns of Texas to the heartland villages of Michigan, from the sun-kissed shores of Florida to the endless fields of the Dakotas, and from the historic streets of Philadelphia to right here in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., the golden age of America is upon us. The revolution that began in 1776 has not ended. It still continues because the flame of liberty and independence still burns in the heart of every American patriot. And our future will be bigger, better, brighter, bolder, and more glorious than ever before. Thank you, God bless you, and God bless America. Thank you.
That was U.S. President Donald Trump delivering his State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress. He opened his speech with a defiant message, saying America is back, bigger, better, richer, stronger than ever before. He highlighted what he called a transformation like no one has seen before. He said inflation is plummeting, incomes are rising. He stressed that, quote, the roaring economy is roaring like never before, and said that America is respected again. He touted his achievements on employment, his big, beautiful bill passing the largest tax cuts in American history, and his signature tariffs. He said almost all countries want to keep to the trade deals they've made with the U.S., calling the Supreme Court's recent ruling disappointing. When it comes to the cost of living and affordability, he highlighted lower gasoline prices and mortgage rates. He lauded his crackdown on crime, defending his deployment of troops to make major cities safe again. On foreign policy, the U.S. leader reiterated his claim that he's ended 8 wars in 10 months. He spoke about America's tensions with Iran, reiterating that the U.S. will never allow Tehran to acquire nuclear weapons and threaten the U.S. or its allies. Simon Marks has been tracking the speech for CNA, and he joins us now from Washington, D.C. Simon, we were expecting a very long
speech. Well, Ronnie, I thought that was just an extraordinary...
He delivered clearly on that very long speech. Walk us through some of his key remarks.
Yeah, well, this was a shorter speech than the White House had led us to believe. By my watch, it clocked in at 1 hour, 47 minutes and 30 seconds. The White House had been saying it could be two and a half hours. Look, I think the overriding impression that Donald Trump gave tonight was of discipline, of being on message, and of being energetic. And for Democrats, what we've witnessed over the last nearly 2 hours is confounding, because so many Democrats have said to themselves, he's slowing down, he's off message, he can't be disciplined. It's all coming to a tumble for the Trump administration. And what I think Donald Trump sought to do tonight, and many analysts may conclude that he did succeed in doing, was to breathe new life into his party's hopes of retaining power in Congress this November. He goaded Democrats time and time again, engaging in a couple of masterstrokes of political theatre. I think the speech will best be remembered for the moment that President Trump challenged every House and Senate lawmaker, Democrat and Republican, to stand up if you agree with this statement. The first duty of the American government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens. And of course, every single Republican in the room immediately leapt to their feet, and every single Democrat in the room, and remember, we now know that 80 Democrats stayed out of the room and boycotted the speech, but those who were there sat on their hands, and in the cutaway shots, many of them, you could tell it was etched into their faces, they knew that they had fallen for an element of political theatre that Republicans are going to use again and again and again in their midterm election campaign. We see President Trump now leaving the chamber as thunderous applause continues for him from Republicans and others, members of the public and others gathered in the room. Other elements that were confounding, I think, to Democrats were the numerous occasions on which President Trump, a man who is often accused of not valuing members of the military and demeaning them, President Trump handed out some of the nation's top honors to military veterans and to current active duty troops, including one member of the force that had traveled to Venezuela to capture President Nicolas Maduro. Again and again, this was a president honoring the military. We're now getting ready for the official rebuttal from the Democrats. It's coming from Governor Abigail Spanberger of Virginia, a centrist Democrat. She's going to be speaking in just a couple of minutes' time and providing the Democrats official rebuttal to that speech. But despite the numerous falsehoods that the president engaged in during the speech, often overstating or misstating his own record in office, there is no question that Republicans in that room were absolutely energized by what they heard tonight. And the president will be hoping that grassroots Make America Great Again supporters and perhaps even some independents will also similarly have been impressed with the presentation that he provided.
You had mentioned the numerous falsehoods in Mr. Trump's speech. Now, he reiterated that he ended 8 wars. How much of his address touched on conflicts abroad and his role in them?
Well, you know, most of the speech, Rani, as you will have heard, was focused on domestic issues, the economy, immigration, crime, law and order, and what he says are Democrat intentions to cheat in the midterm elections later this year, a passionate cry for Congress to pass voter ID laws here in the United States. And again, he shamed the Democrats over that. But in terms of international policy, I mean, he constantly overstates his accomplishments in terms of ending wars. Many of those 8 wars that he claims to have ended were in fact cross-border skirmishes, like the one between Cambodia and Thailand. They weren't full-blown wars that he managed to bring to an end. I think there will have been enormous interest in what he had to say about Iran. He said, "We haven't yet heard the secret words. We commit never to having a nuclear weapon." In fact, the Iranian foreign minister said precisely that on social media hours before President Trump's speech began. But the president indicated that while he favors the idea of diplomacy, he says that's his preference with Iran, he clearly sounded like a man ready to take possible military action against Iran. And he certainly arrayed the most powerful assembly of American power in the region since the war on Iraq in 2003. And then, of course, there was the tariffs issue where, you know, he basically appeared to indicate that in some ways the Supreme Court had done him a favor, even though their decision last Friday to eviscerate the tariffs that lie at the heart of his trade and foreign and national security policies was unfortunate. At one point, he said, very unfortunate. He went on to insist that tariffs are absolutely going to remain in place, that he has got statutes and authorities at his disposal that he can continue to use without seeking congressional authority. So on that, he was very, very muscular.
Simon, this speech was key for Mr. Trump to stop his slide in ratings. Did he do enough, do you think, with midterms coming up later this year?
Well, I think he certainly outperformed the expectations that many observers in the United States had for this speech. He stuck to the script. That is not something we ever see from Donald Trump. If you look side by side at the Donald Trump who made that speech and the Donald Trump who engaged in a rambling press conference on the first anniversary of his return to power last month, those are two completely different politicians. This was a focused and disciplined president of the United States firing the starting gun for his party in its efforts to retain power on Capitol Hill. I think the big question is, can he do it a second time? Is this a flash in the pan, or is this a new Donald Trump that we're going to see time and again on the campaign trail? Can he summon the energy? Now let's listen to the rebuttal from Governor Abigail Spanberger, Democrat of Virginia.
We are gathered here in the chambers of the House of Burgesses. In 1705, the people of the Virginia colony gathered here to take on the extraordinary task of governing themselves. Before there was a Declaration of Independence, a Constitution, or a Bill of Rights, there were people in this room. The people who served here ultimately dreamed of what a new nation, unlike anything the world had ever seen, could be. The United States was founded on the idea that ordinary people could reject the unacceptable excesses of poor leadership, band together to demand better of their government and create a nation that would be an example for the world. And this year, as we celebrate 250 years since America declared our independence from tyranny, I can think of no better place to speak to you as we reflect on the current state of our union. Tonight, as we watched our nation's lawmakers gather for a joint session of Congress, we did not hear the truth from our president. So let's speak plainly and honestly. And let me ask you, the American people watching at home, three questions. Is the president working to make life more affordable for you and your family? Is the president working to keep Americans safe both at home and abroad? Is the president working for you? As I campaigned for governor last year, I traveled to every corner of Virginia, and I heard the same pressing concern everywhere. Costs are too high in housing, healthcare, energy, and childcare. And I know these same conversations are being had all across this country. Because since this president took office last year, his reckless trade policies have forced American families to pay more than $1,700 each in tariff costs. Small businesses have suffered, farmers have suffered, some losing entire markets. Everyday Americans are paying the price. And even though the Supreme Court struck these tariffs down 4 days ago, the damage to us, the American people, has already been done. Meanwhile, the president is planning for new tariffs, another massive tax hike on you and your family. And Republicans in Congress, they remain unwilling to assert their constitutional authority to stop him. They're making your life harder. They're making your life more expensive. They're even making it more difficult to see a doctor. Rural health clinics in Virginia and across the country are already closing their doors thanks to the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, championed by the president and Republicans in Congress. And tonight, the president celebrated this law, the one threatening rural hospitals, stripping health care from millions of Americans and driving up costs in energy and housing, all while cutting food programs for hungry kids. But here in Virginia, I am working with our state legislature to lower costs and make the Commonwealth more affordable. And it's not just me. Democrats across the country are laser focused on affordability in our nation's capital and in state capitals and communities across America. In the most innovative and exceptional nation in the history of the world, Americans deserve to know that their leaders are focused on addressing the problems that keep them up at night. Problems that dictate where you live, whether you can afford to start a business, or whether you have to skip a prescription in order to buy groceries. So I'll ask again, is the president working to make life more affordable for you and your family? We all know the answer is no. I grew up in a house of service. My mother was a nurse, and my father was a career law enforcement officer. I began my career by following in my father's footsteps as a federal agent working money laundering and narcotics cases. I worked side by side with local and state police to keep our community safe and to uphold and enforce the law. Law enforcement officers across the country know that it is a unique responsibility to do the serious work of investigating crimes, comforting victims, and making arrests. It's about building trust, and that requires an abiding sense of duty and commitment to community. And yet, our president has sent poorly trained federal agents into our cities, where they have arrested and detained American citizens and people who aspire to be Americans. And they have done it without a warrant. They have ripped nursing mothers away from their babies. They have sent children, a little boy in a blue bunny hat, children to far-off detention centers. And they have killed American citizens in our streets. And they have done it all with their faces masked from accountability. Every minute spent sowing fear is a minute not spent investigating murders, crimes against children, or the criminals defrauding.
That was the Democratic response to President Trump's State of the Union address from Virginia Governor Abigail Spanberger. Let's go back to Simon for the reaction to President Trump's speech there. Simon, quite a strong reaction there. She claimed that America did not hear the truth from the president.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that what Abigail Spanberger there, the governor of Virginia, newly elected, was seeking to do was essentially to say to Americans, are you better off today than you were a year ago? Do you think that the president is prioritizing affordability in your life? And she said plainly, the answer is no. She's trying to bring Americans back to Earth. Following President Trump's speech, also asking the question, is he making the country safer? Remember that President Trump excoriated Democrats for what is still a partial government shutdown here with the Department of Homeland Security, ICE and the Border Patrol, the president's masked federal agents who had to be withdrawn from Minneapolis just within the last couple of weeks following the killing by them on the streets of Minneapolis of two American citizens, Renee Good and Alex Pretty. The president excoriated Democrats for not funding the Department of Homeland Security and allowing it to continue going about its work. But Governor Spanberger there absolutely intimating that President Trump has made the streets of America less safe, even as he, in his speech, attempted to brand the Democrats the party of crime, murder, and disorder. So what you're seeing in these two speeches are the contours of the midterm election campaign. I think it's important to underscore that Governor Spanberger is a centrist Democrat. She does not represent particularly the left-wing grassroots of the party, people like Zoran Mamdani, the new mayor of New York City, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She is a woman who has told Democrats never publicly to articulate the word socialist again. So the fact that she's making this rebuttal speech tonight, while so many members of the left of the Democratic Party are at their own event here in Washington, D.C., the State of the Swamp event, is indicative of divisions within the Democratic Party that it still needs to sort out as the midterm election campaign gets underway. But what she was seeking to do was to underscore that many of the things that President Trump claimed were either false, overstated, or misinterpreted, and attempting to urge those people still watching television here at 11:15 at night on the East Coast in the United States to understand that what Donald Trump was presenting, she is arguing, is a pastiche of what is actually taking place in the United States with regard to economy, law and order, the crackdown on immigration, the mass deportations, and all the other issues that have dominated the headlines over the last year.
Thank you, Simon, for sharing those updates and insights with us. That was Simon Marks reporting live from Washington, D.C. And for more insight on President Trump's address before Congress, let's speak with Tricia Craig, Executive Director at the Princeton Institute for International and Regional Studies. Tricia, thank you for making the time to join us today. President Trump, he covered a lot in that very lengthy speech. Let's start off with your initial reaction to the address. What were your three main takeaways?
Ryan, first of all, it's great to be here. One of the things I think that we have to recognize is that this is a speech for the record books. It is the longest State of the Union speech now on record, surpassing Bill Clinton's. And I think in that length, there were several different speeches going on. The first one, which is I think a direct response to his lagging polling. His approval ratings are down. Going into the midterms this year in November, this is seen as dangerous for the Republicans. Issues that he hit on, all the domestic issues, things like affordability, things like immigration, he came out swinging because he is not doing well in the polling on all of those. And this, in some ways, was a campaign speech. So I think that's kind of the first reaction. The second is that it had really a theatrical quality to it. This is where Trump, the showman, the apprentice, all of his really theatrics came through. It's very unusual to see presenting medals. We saw numerous servicemen being honored, but also things, the surprises. The woman who was reunited with her jailed Venezuelan uncle. This is the kind of thing that makes for great television, but is unusual in a State of the Union. And then the third takeaway is that in addition to the domestic issues, there was, I think, somewhat less emphasis on foreign policy, but we did get some insights into foreign policy.
We'll get back to the foreign policy point. Now, on tariffs, the Supreme Court ruling has pretty much blunted Mr. Trump's favorite geopolitical tool, but he claims that he will not need congressional approval despite that ruling. Let's listen to what he said.
Despite the disappointing ruling, these powerful country saving, it's saving our country, the kind of money we're taking in, peace protecting. Many of the wars I settled was because of the threat of tariffs. I wouldn't have been able to settle them with a... will remain in place under fully approved and tested alternative legal statutes. And they have been tested for a long time. They're a little more complex, but they're actually probably better, leading to a solution that will be even stronger than before. Congressional action will not be necessary. It's already time-tested and approved. And as time goes by, I believe the tariffs paid for by foreign countries will, like in the past, substantially replace the modern-day system of income tax, taking a great financial burden off the people that I love.
The U.S. president also took aim at the Democrats in Congress, saying they cut off funding for the Department of Homeland Security. Mr. Trump then issued a challenge to the room. Let's listen.
We're able to find enough of that fraud. We will actually have a balanced budget overnight. It'll go very quickly. That's the kind of money you're talking about. We'll balance our budget. The Somali pirates who ransacked Minnesota remind us that there are large parts of the world where bribery, corruption, and lawlessness are the norm, not the exception. Importing these cultures through unrestricted immigration and open borders brings those problems right here to the USA. And it is the American people who pay the price in higher medical bills, car insurance rates, rent, taxes, and perhaps most importantly, crime. We will take care of this problem. We're going to take care of this problem. We are not playing games.
Tricia, so when President Trump entered office, immigration was among his strongest issues. Now, during that speech, he made a lot of bold claims about zero illegal immigrants entering the country, reducing fentanyl trafficking into the U.S. What are your thoughts about that? What do you make of the picture that he presented on immigration?
I think this was really striking. And this, I think, is in direct response to his really falling polling numbers on how immigration is being handled. You're absolutely right. This is one of his signature issues. It is largely, I think, what allowed him to be elected. His under the Biden administration, the southern border in the U.S. was fairly open, and he came in promising to change that. However, with the activities of ICE, for example, in Minnesota, with the deportation of not the worst of the worst, but law-abiding people who had been here often in the process of trying to become citizens. There's been a real change in public opinion. Throughout this speech, we got graphic examples, really often very gory, about illegal immigrants. And so I think he's going back to that idea of, you know, they don't send us their best. They send us rapists. They send us criminals. They send us people out of institutions. And this is really, I think, trying to go back to one of his earlier campaign playbooks of demonizing immigrants, when in fact, the vast majority of people who've been deported have no criminal records, and we're seeing a lot of opposition to the tactics, the masked law enforcement officers who are taking people out of their homes, and this is going to be an issue in the upcoming election.
It's clearly a key issue because he got a standing ovation when he said, and I quote, "The first duty of the American government is to protect American citizens, not illegal aliens." You know, despite the criticism that his deadly ICE crackdown has been facing, what is driving support for this policy?
Well, I think there are there is a substantial part of the American people who would like to see a different kind of immigration policy, one that is more restrictive, one that is perhaps talent-based. But at the same time, people in their own communities don't necessarily want to see their neighbors who are immigrants rounded up and deported. But I think the way that his sort of language and examples are demonizing the immigrant community in the U.S., particularly the sort of really virulent attacks on Somalis in Minnesota, he's trying to break through the idea that we need to have less tolerance of people who are here illegally. And I think this is going to be something that we see on the campaign trail.
I want to shift now to tariffs again. The Supreme Court ruling, as we mentioned, you know, has said that his tariffs were illegal. But he's clearly still pushing that his tariffs will remain in place. How exactly? How does he plan to do this?
Well, I think the issue of tariffs is quite complex, the way that he talks about their the effect of tariffs. He insists that it is foreign countries paying tariffs, when in fact these are typically tariffs that are costs that are passed on to the end consumer. And we've seen in the last couple of days, with the tariff ruling by the Supreme Court, a number of big companies like FedEx and things like that asking for refunds on these tariffs that have been deemed illegal. There is some justification in law, although it is a contentious point, whether the 10% that the president has announced is something that he can do unilaterally without the backing of Congress. These are not permanent tariffs. They have, I think, 180 days. There are things that are exempted from them. But he's also saying that any countries that had already negotiated other levels of tariffs, often higher than 10%, that they'll be happy to stick with them. We'll see if that's true. But one of the things I think that was really interesting about the way he sort of looked at tariffs as all-encompassing, it's not just you know, his sort of idea that this is a way to redress problems of countries taking advantage in the past of the U.S., but he also sees it in much broader terms. When he talked about, for example, the use of tariffs as a sort of tool in ending conflicts, that, you know, this is how we get other countries to behave, not just in the economic realm, but in the foreign policy realm. We'll threaten them with tariffs. It's also almost Doge-like, where he talks about, you know, tariffs will eliminate will eliminate fraud. They will eliminate the need for as much income tax. This is really interesting because it's also a very regressive tax, right? So if you're thinking that tariffs will supplant some parts of income tax, you're really talking about making the tax or tariff system much more regressive.
Speaking of ending conflicts, as you had mentioned, he reiterated again that he's ended 8 wars, and he also spoke about the tensions with Iran, vowing that Tehran would never have a nuclear weapon, and claiming also that Iran was working on a missile that could hit the U.S. Let's listen to what he had to say.
As president, I will make peace wherever I can, but I will never hesitate to confront threats to America wherever we must. That's why in a breakthrough operation last June, the United States military obliterated Iran's nuclear weapons program with an attack on Iranian soil known as Operation Midnight Hammer. They were warned to make no future attempts to rebuild their weapons program, and in particular, nuclear weapons, yet they continue. They're starting it all over. We wiped it out, and they want to start all over again. And are at this moment again pursuing their sinister ambitions. We are in negotiations with them. They want to make a deal, but we haven't heard those secret words. We will never have a nuclear weapon. My preference... My preference is to solve this problem through diplomacy. But one thing is certain, I will never allow the world's number one sponsor of terror, which they are by far, to have a nuclear weapon. Can't let that happen.
What message was he sending with those remarks on Tehran?
So right now the U.S. is in negotiations with the Iranians, and there are these negotiations are continuing. It is clear that the attack earlier did not wipe out the Iranian nuclear program. He is, I think, drawing a line in the sand, as I think Simon Marks mentioned. The Iranian foreign minister had said, We are not developing, and we will not develop a nuclear weapon. They can say that, but all sort of evidence of their nuclear program is that they are on course to, at some point, develop a nuclear weapon. This is, I think, is sort of setting the boundaries of the negotiations that are going on now to encourage or sort of force Iran into some kind of verifiable winding down of their nuclear program. If that doesn't happen, then I think it's not clear where the U.S. Right now is intending to go and how far they're intending to go. But we are seeing sort of ramping up of the threat of some kind of more serious conflict right now.
I want to look at his overall speech because economy is a key voter issue as we head into the midterms later this year. Was he able to convince Americans that the economy is doing well? What has he delivered on, and where do you think he has failed?
This was clearly the one of the central messages of the speech. He talked about affordability. This is something that Americans are struggling with, and he really honed in on several of the key areas where Americans are finding their paychecks not going as far. One is the cost of housing, which he talked about, and talking about not allowing corporations to buy up single-family homes. He talked about healthcare, where he talked about getting drug prices down. He also talked about prices in general, sort of grocery prices. And in all of those, I think, even though he's hitting the issues that Americans care most about and are sort of top of mind, I'm not sure that he was utterly convincing, particularly when he's talking about grocery, when he's talking about inflation plummeting. People can see that inflation is, in fact, not plummeting. It has moderated somewhat since he took office, but it is still well above where the Federal Reserve would like to see the targets. In terms of prices coming down, he talked about a couple of grocery items where prices have moderated, but in fact, grocery prices continue to rise. With healthcare, he's talking about bringing drug prices down. There are some drug prices going down, but in other areas, they're still rising. And sort of harkening back to his original 2016 promises to replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare with a different, big, beautiful healthcare policy, you know, we're not getting any specifics about that. And on housing costs, economists don't think that changing the way that the corporate sector can buy up blocks of homes will have a huge impact on affordability of housing. He's also, I think, with housing, trying to reassure particularly people who've held their houses for, who've owned their homes for a long time, that prices won't go down because he's afraid of alienating people who, for whom the wealth that they've built in their homes is one of the biggest parts of their of their personal wealth. So even though he's claiming a lot of progress on the kinds of inflationary issues that Americans care most about, I think he's not necessarily that convincing. And when we look at polling in terms of where people think his handling of the economy is going, he has a lot of ground to make up that this speech, I don't think, has allowed him to do.
One thing I noticed throughout his speech, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, he highlighted the stories of several people that he called American patriots. What was he trying to achieve by doing that?
I think for Trump, who not only has a sort of showman-like quality, I think bringing these kinds of stories to people as sort of stand-ins for data, as sort of feel-goods, is a technique to sort of shift attention away from the areas where he has not lived up to expectations. But it's also, I think it can be a fairly effective way of talking to voters by giving stories that center on real people and real experiences. It's certainly a tried and true political technique, and I think it's one that is very much part of his own sort of his own wheelhouse, his own sort of approach to politics.
Thank you, Tricia, for sharing your insights with us. We were speaking to Tricia Craig, Executive Director at the Princeton Institute for International and Regional Studies. We've been bringing you live coverage and analysis of President Trump's State of the Union address. Keep up with us here on CNA. News and updates continue after this break.